Chapter 10. The Cumberland Doctor's mention of Doncaster races inspired Mr. Francis Goodchild with the idea of going down to Doncaster to see the races. Doncaster being a good way off, and quite out of the way of the idle apprentices, if anything could be out of their way, who had no way, it necessarily followed that Francis perceived Doncaster in the race week to be, of all possible idleness, the particular idleness that would completely satisfy him. Thomas, with an enforced idleness grafted on the natural and voluntary power of his disposition, was not of this mind. Objecting that a man compelled to lie on his back on a floor, a sofa, a table, a line of chairs, or anything he could get to lie upon, was not in racing condition, and that he desired nothing better than to lie where he was, enjoying himself in looking at the flies on the ceiling. But Francis Goodchild, who had been walking round his companion in a circuit of 12 miles for 2 days, and had begun to doubt whether it was reserved for him ever to be idle in his life, not only overpowered this objection, but even converted Thomas Idle to a scheme he formed, another idle inspiration, of conveying the said Thomas to the sea coast, and putting his injured leg under a stream of salt water. Plunging into this happy conception headforemost, Mr. Goodchild immediately referred to the county map, and ardently discovered that the most delicious piece of sea coast to be found within the limits of England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, the Isle of Man, and the Channel Islands, all summed up together, was along beyond the coast of Cumberland. There was the coast of Scotland opposite to Allonby, said Mr. Goodchild with enthusiasm. There was a fine Scottish mountain on that Scottish coast. There were Scottish lights to be seen shining across the glorious channel, and at Allonby itself there was every idle luxury, no doubt, that a watering place could offer to the heart of idle man. Moreover, said Mr. Goodchild, with his finger on the map, this exquisite retreat was approached by a coach road, from a railway station called Aspatria, a name, in a manner, suggestive of the departed glories of Greece, associated with one of the most engaging and most famous of Greek women. On this point, Mr. Goodchild continued at intervals to breathe a vein of classic fancy and eloquence exceedingly irksome to Mr. Idle, until it appeared that the honest English pronunciation of that Cumberland country shortened Aspatria into Spatter. Apostrophe after this supplementary discovery, Mr. Goodchild said no more about it. By way of Spatter, the crippled idol was carried, hoisted, pushed, poked, and packed, into and out of carriages, into and out of beds, into and out of tavern resting places, until he was brought at length within sniff of the sea. And now, behold the apprentices gallantly riding into Allonby in a one-horse fly, bent upon staying in that peaceful marine valley until the turbulent Doncaster time shall come round upon the wheel, in its turn among what are in sporting registers called the fixtures for the month. Do you see Allonby? Apostrophe apostrophe asked Thomas Idle. I don't see it yet, apostrophe said Francis, looking out of window. It must be there, apostrophe said Thomas Idle. I don't see it, apostrophe returned Francis. It must be there, apostrophe repeated Thomas Idle, fretfully. Lord bless me! Apostrophe apostrophe exclaimed Francis, drawing in his head, I suppose this is it. Apostrophe apostrophe, a watering place, apostrophe retorted Thomas Idle, with the pardonable sharpness of an invalid. Can't be 5 gentlemen in straw hats, on the form on one side of a door, and 4 ladies in hats and falls, on the form on another side of a door, and 3 geese in a dirty little brook before them, and a boy's legs hanging over a bridge,
with a boy's body I suppose on the other side of the parapet,
and a donkey running away. What are you talking about? Apostrophe, Allonby, gentlemen, apostrophe said the most comfortable of landladies as she opened one door of the carriage. Allonby, gentlemen, apostrophe said the most attentive of landlords, as he opened the other. Thomas Idle yielded his arm to the ready Goodchild, and descended from the vehicle. Thomas, now just able to grope his way along, in a doubled-up condition, with the aid of two thick sticks, was no bad embodiment of Commodore Trunnion, or of one of those many gallant admirals of the stage, who have all ample fortunes, gout, thick sticks, tempers, warts, and nephews. With this distinguished naval appearance upon him, Thomas made a crab-like progress up a clean little bulk-headed staircase, into a clean little bulk-headed room, where he slowly deposited himself on a sofa, with a stick on either hand of him, looking exceedingly grim. Francis, apostrophe said Thomas Idle, what do you think of this place? Apostrophe, I think, apostrophe returned Mr. Goodchild, in a glowing way, it is everything we expected. Apostrophe, ha! Apostrophe, apostrophe said Thomas Idle. There is the sea, apostrophe cried Mr. Goodchild, pointing out of window, and here, apostrophe pointing to the lunch on the table, are shrimps. Let us apostrophe here Mr. Goodchild looked out of window, as if in search of something, and looked in again, let us eat 'em. Apostrophe, the shrimps eaten and the dinner ordered, Mr. Goodchild went out to survey the watering place. As chorus of the drama, without whom Thomas could make nothing of the scenery, he by and by returned, to have the following report screwed out of him. In brief, it was the most delightful place ever seen. But, apostrophe Thomas Idle asked, where is it? Apostrophe, it's what you may call generally up and down the beach, here and there, apostrophe said Mr. Goodchild, with a twist of his hand. Proceed, apostrophe said Thomas Idle. It was, Mr. Goodchild went on to say, in cross-examination, what you might call a primitive place. Large? No, it was not large. Whoever expected it would be large? Shape? What a question to ask. No shape. What sort of a street? Why, no street. Shops? Yes, of course, quite indignant. How many? Whoever went into a place to count the shops? Ever so many. Six? Perhaps. A library? Why, of course, indignant again. Good collection of books? Most likely couldn't say, had seen nothing in it, but a pair of scales. Any reading room? Of course, there was a reading room. Where? Where? Why, over there. Where was over there? Why, there. Let Mr. Idle carry his eye to that bit of waste ground above high water mark, where the rank grass and loose stones were most in a litter, and he would see a sort of long, ruinous brick loft, next door to a ruinous brick outhouse, which loft had a ladder outside, to get up by. That was the reading room, and if Mr. Idle didn't like the idea of a weaver's shuttle throbbing under a reading room, that was his lookout. He was not to dictate, Mr. Goodchild supposed, indignant again, to the company. By the by, apostrophe Thomas Idle observed. The company? Apostrophe, well. Mr. Goodchild went on to report, very nice company. Where were they? Why, there they were. Mr. Idle could see the tops of their hats, he supposed. What? Those nine straw hats again, five gentlemen's and four ladies? Yes, to be sure. Mr. Goodchild hoped the company were not to be expected to wear helmets, to please Mr. Idle. Beginning to recover his temper at about this point, Mr. Goodchild voluntarily reported that, if he wanted to be primitive, you could be primitive here, and that if he wanted to be idle, you could be idle here. In the course of some days, he added, that there were three fishing boats, but no rigging, and that there were plenty of fishermen who never fished. That they got their living entirely, by looking at the ocean. What nourishment they looked out of it to support their strength, he couldn't say, but, he supposed it was some sort of iodine. The place was full of their children, who were always upside down on the public buildings, two small bridges over the brook, and always hurting themselves or one another, so that their wailings made more continual noise in the air than could have been got in a busy place. The houses people lodged in were nowhere in particular, and were in capital accordance with the beach, being all more or less cracked and damaged as its shells were, and all empty as its shells were. Among them was an edifice of destitute appearance, with a number of wall-eyed windows in it, looking desperately out to Scotland, as if for help, which said it was a bazaar and it ought to know, and where you might buy anything you wanted, supposing what you wanted was a little camp stool or a child's wheelbarrow. The brook crawled or stopped between the houses and the sea, and the donkey was always running away, and when he got into the brook he was pelted out with stones, which never hit him, and which always hit some of the children who were upside down on the public buildings, and made their lamentations louder. This donkey was the public excitement of Allonby, and was probably supported at the public expense. The foregoing descriptions, delivered in separate items, on separate days of adventurous discovery, Mr. Goodchild severally wound up, by looking out of window, looking in again, and saying, "But there is the sea, and here are the shrimps, let us eat them." Apostrophe, there were fine sunsets at Allonby, when the low flat beach, with its pools of water and its dry patches, changed into long bars of silver and gold in various states of burnishing, and there were fine views on fine days of the Scottish coast. But, when it rained at Allonby, Allonby thrown back upon its ragged self, became a kind of place which the donkey seemed to have found out, and to have his highly sagacious reasons for wishing to bolt from. Thomas Idle observed, too, that Mr. Goodchild, with a noble show of disinterestedness, became every day more ready to walk to Maryport and back, for letters, and suspicions began to harbor in the mind of Thomas, that his friend deceived him, and that Maryport was a preferable place. Therefore, Thomas said to Francis on a day, when they had looked at the sea, and eaten the shrimps, "My mind misgives me, good child, that you go to Maryport, like the boy in the story book, to ask it to be idle with you." Apostrophe, judge then, apostrophe, returned Francis, adopting the style of the story book, with what success. "I go to a region which is a bit of waterside Bristol, with a slice of Wapping, a seasoning of Wolverhampton, and a garnish of Portsmouth, and I say, 'Will you come, and be idle with me?' And it answers, 'No, for I am a great deal too vaporous, and a great deal too rusty, and a great deal too muddy, and a great deal too dirty altogether. And I have ships to load, and pitch and tar to boil, and iron to hammer, and steam to get up, and smoke to make, and stone to quarry, and 50 other disagreeable things to do, and I can't be idle with you.' Then I go into jagged uphill and downhill streets, where I am in the pastrycook's shop at one moment, and next moment in savage fastnesses of moor and morass, beyond the confines of civilization, and I say to those murky and black moldy streets, 'Will you come, and be idle with me?' To which they reply, 'No, we can't, indeed, for we haven't the spirits, and we are startled by the echo of your feet on the sharp pavement, and we have so many goods in our shop windows which nobody wants, and we have so much to do for a limited public which never comes to us to be done for, that we are altogether out of sorts, and can't enjoy ourselves with anyone. So I go to the post office, and knock at the shutter, and I say to the postmaster, 'Will you come, and be idle with me?' To which he rejoins, 'No, I really can't, for I live, as you may see, in such a very little post office, and pass my life behind such a very little shutter, that my hand, when I put it out, is as the hand of a giant crammed through the window of a dwarf's house at a fair, and I am a mere post office anchorite in a cell much too small for him, and I can't get out, and I can't get in, and I have no space to be idle in, even if I would.' So, the boy, apostrophe, said Mr. Goodchild, concluding the tale, comes back with the letters after all, and lives happy never afterwards. Apostrophe, but it may, not unreasonably, be asked, while Francis Goodchild was wandering hither and thither, storing his mind with perpetual observation of men and things, and sincerely believing himself to be the laziest creature in existence all the time, how did Thomas Idle, crippled and confined to the house, contrive to get through the hours of the day? Prone on the sofa, Thomas made no attempt to get through the hours, but passively allowed the hours to get through him. Where other men in his situation would have read books and improved their minds, Thomas slept and rested his body. Where other men would have pondered anxiously over their future prospects, Thomas dreamed lazily of his past life. The one solitary thing he did, which most other people would have done in his place, was to resolve on making certain alterations and improvements in his mode of existence, as soon as the effects of the misfortune that had overtaken him had all passed away. Remembering that the current of his life had hitherto oozed along in one smooth stream of laziness, occasionally troubled on the surface by a slight passing ripple of industry, his present ideas on the subject of self-reform inclined him not, as the reader may be disposed to imagine, to project schemes for a new existence of enterprise and exertion, but, on the contrary, to resolve that he would never, if he could possibly help it, be active or industrious again throughout the whole of his future career. It is due to Mr. Idle to relate that his mind sauntered towards this peculiar conclusion on distinct and logically producible grounds. After reviewing, quite at his ease, and with many needful intervals of repose, the generally placid spectacle of his past existence, he arrived at the discovery that all the great disasters which had tried his patience and equanimity in early life had been caused by his having allowed himself to be deluded into imitating some pernicious example of activity and industry that had been set him by others. The trials to which he here alludes were three in number, and may be thus reckoned up. First, the disaster of being an unpopular and a thrashed boy at school. Secondly, the disaster of falling seriously ill. Thirdly, the disaster of becoming acquainted with a great bore. The first disaster occurred after Thomas had been an idle and a popular boy at school for some happy years. One Christmas time, he was stimulated by the evil example of a companion, whom he had always trusted and liked, to be untrue to himself, and to try for a prize at the ensuing half-yearly examination. He did try, and he got a prize. How, he did not distinctly know at the moment, and cannot remember now. No sooner, however, had the book Moral Hints to the Young on the Value of Time been placed in his hands, than the first troubles of his life began. The idle boys deserted him, as a traitor to their cause. The industrious boys avoided him, as a dangerous interloper. One of their number, who had always won the prize on previous occasions, expressing just resentment at the invasion of his privileges by calling Thomas into the playground, and then and there administering to him the first sound and genuine thrashing that he had ever received in his life. Unpopular from that moment, as a beaten boy, who belonged to no side, and was rejected by all parties, young Idle soon lost caste with his masters, as he had previously lost caste with his schoolfellows. He had forfeited the comfortable reputation of being the one lazy member of the youthful community whom it was quite hopeless to punish. Never again did he hear the headmaster say reproachfully to an industrious boy who had committed a fault, "I might have expected this in Thomas Idle, but it is inexcusable, sir, in you, who know better." Apostrophe never more, after winning that fatal prize, did he escape the retributive imposition, or the avenging birch. From that time, the masters made him work, and the boys would not let him play. From that time his social position steadily declined, and his life at school became a perpetual burden to him. So, again, with the second disaster. While Thomas was lazy, he was a model of health. His first attempt at active exertion, and his first suffering from severe illness, are connected together by the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.